protected. This was my first I've been on business travel outside the U.S., but I've never been on a missions trip. And so this was my first time, and this is my first Gideon trip outside the U.S. too. And so I didn't really know what to expect. They really didn't give you very much information at headquarters as to, I assumed we would have some sort of team meeting or something over the phone before we went. That wasn't the case. It was just an email, get on the plane and get your doctor's release in. I was thinking I would have to get Holly to sign my waiver for me. My doctor wouldn't sign it, but my doctor did. I finally saw a doctor. And so that was successful. But the whole time we were there, it was just a wonderful time, and so I want to share that with you. We gave out Bibles in the hotel rooms. These are just like the ones we give out in the U.S. in Bibles. But in schools and clinics and the lower-class hotels, we gave out these Chinese, they're called Simple Chinese and English Bibles, or it's a New Testament. And then we also gave out a lot of Chinese New Testaments to the school kids and clinics. And we also gave out a lot of Tamil, which is the Indian language. And so I'll pass these around. You can look at them. And the trip was designed to be a scripture blitz. I'll tell you just a little bit about that in a minute. But we were supposed to give out 50,000 Bibles and New Testaments. It turned out we only gave out about 38,600. And I said only. That's a large number. But typically on these international blitzes, they'll give out hundreds of thousands. In fact, at the Philippines last year, I think they gave out well over a million. So this was sort of atypical of a distribution. The way the Gideons work, just to fill you in if you're not familiar with the ministry, is we form camps. And in these camps, we cover all the boundaries throughout the U.S. and throughout the world. And in Albuquerque, there's five camps, and then there's a camp in Belen and Rio Rancho and Santa Fe. So we cover sort of territories. And we do this throughout the world. And so the idea is that we don't just, through the money that you give through the church, and about a third of that comes back to our local camp where we purchase scriptures to give locally to schools and hospitals and hotels. And the other money goes to international, which goes towards these blitzes. And so we don't just take the Bibles and New Testaments and leave them somewhere. We have the Gideons throughout the world hand them out one by one to the hotels or the clinics. So all the money that you give goes to the purchase of Bibles and New Testaments, and none of the money you give goes to our administration overhead. So all these scripture blitzes and all are funded by just, like, I had to pay my own way to go. So we didn't get any money back from international. The way the camps work is they're supposed to distribute in their local area, and they're supposed to keep all the hotels full of Bibles and do schools. But a lot of times that doesn't happen for the weaker camps, and a lot of times it's hard to keep up with in the bigger cities. So like in Albuquerque and Phoenix and Dallas and Denver, what we'll do is every 7 years we'll have what we call a scripture blitz. And there we'll go into every hotel, pull back all the Bibles from the hotels, and take the covers off and use those Bibles for prison Bibles. And then we'll put new Bibles in all the hotel rooms. And then we'll also do all the other distributions too, the hospitals, the clinics, the schools, colleges and universities and mid schools and high schools. So that's supposed to happen every 7 years. And so as you might imagine, if it's hard to do that in the U.S. to keep everybody motivated to keep that going, it's harder throughout the rest of the world. And so the idea of the scripture blitz is to sort of come alongside the local Gideons there throughout the world and sort of not show them the way we do it in the U.S., but to help them to be part of their team. So I guess I can control this. Last year, we gave out almost 90 million Bibles and New Testaments throughout the world. Of those, 70% of them went to students, both most of them to mid schools and high schools. And of those 90 million, about 12% of them, or somewhere around 10 million, were placed in the United States. But of all the money collected, it was about 75% of the money comes from the U.S. for the rest of the world. So we still are, the U.S. is still the most giving country in the world. We fund virtually 75% of the whole Gideon ministry and only take back 10%. So we had a training session yesterday at Hoffmantown, and we were reminded that we're not a Bible society, so our purpose isn't just to sell Bibles or put Bibles out there. Our purpose is evangelism, and so we always try to keep that in mind. We get hung up sometimes in the numbers of how many we give out, but the idea is to win souls for Christ, and that's our main mission. So I'm not going to go through this totally, but the scripture blitzes then are a planned event. It's not something that just happens randomly. The in Malaysia, the group there had been planning for over a year for this blitz. And of course, it turned out I was blessed more than I could ever give back in return. I'll never view the worldwide Christian church or the worldwide Gideon ministry the same. I'll talk about that just a little bit more. I'll never go on another distribution here in the U.S. without thinking about the freedoms that we have in this country, the freedom of religion and freedom of speech. And I'll talk a little bit about more about that, too. The thing that surprised me most when I went on the trip, and I guess I just wasn't expecting this, was just the Christian love that was poured out by the Christians there in Malaysia towards our team. It was just really incredible to have that. I'd never really, I mean, I know all you guys love me, but it wasn't clear that they would. So the Malaysia Scripture Blitz, it was in the area of Penang. I'll show you where that is. And we had five people from the U.S. go and one person from Germany. Our team leader was Larry Aspergen. He's about 77 years old, but had tons of energy. We had about 49 participants from the local area. There were more than six camps were involved. I sort of lost track of who was from each camp. We distributed at hotels, motels, mid-schools, high schools, colleges, clinics, and law offices. So that's the typical distributions that we will do. And we distributed in Chinese, English, and Tamil. Now, the official language in Malaysia is Malay, but it's illegal in Malaysia to print or distribute scriptures in Malay. So that's problematic. Malay scriptures are printed and distributed in Indonesia, though. So I'll just show you where Malaysia is located. I learned a lot about geography, never being to the area of China or anything before. I learned a lot. So Malaysia is really made up of two parts. There's peninsular Malaysia here where the capital is, Kuala Lumpur, and then another part of Malaysia, which is sort of the mainland located there. It's very close to the equator. Singapore is just on the tip of peninsular Malaysia. And I learned this that from my neighbor who's Chinese. He said that Shanghai, which is located there, that's about the same latitude as El Paso. And so where we were, though, was very close to the equator, and it was very hot and humid. This shows a blow-up of Malaysia, and you can see the region where we were sort of located, and the little red area is where we were sort of centered around. So we weren't in Kuala Lumpur. We were in this area called the state of Penang. The area of Malaysia is about 330,000 square kilometers, and it has a population of 31 million. And the peninsular part is about a third of that, but has about 22 million people. Compare that to New Mexico, that has about 314,000 square kilometers and 2.1 million people. So the whole area of Malaysia is about the same as New Mexico, but it has about 10 times or about 15 times the population. So zooming in closer, this is the area we were located. So this is sort of the state of Penang. We covered an area mostly around Penang Island, which is right here. There's an international airport there. And we went about 2 hours north and 2 hours south by driving to cover these cities that were in this area. the city, these were sort of the cities that we covered. I can really only pronounce three of them here: Penang Island, Georgetown, and then Butterworth. And so, but those are the other cities that we covered as well. This is then zooming in the area of Penang itself. And so this is Penang Island. There's a bridge that goes down and further south of here that's not shown on the picture, but we use this bridge a lot. This is a famous picture I'll show you, Penang Bridge. And we had our headquarters located actually across from the island. So the international airport's right here, but our hotel was located in a little city called Butterworth. Now, what they do for industry a lot in Penang is on the north side here of the island is a resort area. Here's the city, Georgetown. And then this area here is very industrialized. A lot of electronics industry is done there since there's an international airport. And then in this area on the mainland, north of Butterworth, is where they grow a lot of crops. They grow a lot of rice. It's called the breadbasket of Malaysia. And they grow a lot of palm trees. So this is just a picture you may have seen of Kuala Lumpur. Of course, we didn't go here, but the two towers are what you would probably recognize, and the walking bridge that goes across the capital has 1.5 million people. And then this is sort of the famous bridge that is 15 years old, goes from the main island to goes from Penang Island to the mainland. And Penang has about 1.4 million people. I'm not going to go through all the origins. I just looked this up for my own interest. And it was a British colony, and then it was occupied by the Japanese during World War II. But it became its own country in 1957, and it unified with North Borneo, Sarawak, and Singapore in 1963. But then, at least in Wikipedia, they say this: they expelled Singapore in 1965. I don't know if it was actually expelled or if Singapore wanted to go on its own. When I talked to the people there, though, that were in my group, they were very anti-communist. And so they said the heritage there in Malaysia was very anti-communist. The government's parliamentary, but it's controlled by the Muslims, and it's ruled by a sultan. And so there's some 50 or 60 states in Malaysia. Each one has a sultan that I don't think he's elected. I don't think he's an elected person. I think he's in it for life. And then those sultans, every number of years, picks like the head sultan, and that's this person. They act sort of like a king. They really don't have any power. The parliament has the power. The Malaysian culture, it's made up of 64% Malay, and these are the Muslims. So I couldn't get straight. They would call the other people, the people in my group, they would call the other people Malay, and or sometimes they say Muslims, and I could never figure out the difference, if there was really a difference between them, who they were talking about. About 27% is Chinese, and so these are sort of indigenous or Chinese people. I was trying to figure this out. It must be sort of like where we have Mexican people here in the U.S. who have been here a long time. That's sort of the idea, the Chinese people who live there. 8% Indians and 1% indigenous. And the native languages are Malay, Chinese, Mandarin, Tamil, and English. So all the people spoke English. I couldn't get that out of Wikipedia when I went, so I wasn't really sure what to expect when I got there, but everybody spoke English. But it wasn't an English you could understand. They would talk so fast. It sort of reminds me of my friend Bennett Lee, who's come to church here a few times. He talks so fast, you just got to tell him, just slow down. I can't understand what you're saying. And they would do that too. But then I realized they also didn't understand what I was saying a lot of times. And they used a lot of sort of slang things that I wasn't familiar with. And so that was sort of hard to keep up with. The religion is, there's a state religion, Sunni Islam. They do have freedom of religion for non-Muslims. And again, the breakdown is sort of similar to the types of people. Muslim are 64%. Chinese religion, of which Buddhist is the largest, is 25%. Hindu is 8%. And Christians are only 3%. So a very low, very small Christian population. The industries, of course, is what I told you about, mostly electronics. There are, however, 87 Gideon camps in Malaysia. Malaysia is known for their multicultural food, in particular a mixture of sort of Chinese, Indian, and Malay. And they're famous for what they call street food. So they do have McDonald's and KFCs. They have a lot of KFCs, actually. We didn't go to one. But one nice thing is that all the Malaysia food is cooked. And so, in fact, when talking to the guys there, they said they didn't like to go to Japan for two reasons. One, it was expensive, and two, they ate raw food, and they didn't like raw food at all. But the food was very cheap. I took all the guys, about seven guys, out for dinner one night, and it cost me $25 US for this really nice meal. And so they eat mostly beef, chicken, duck, and some pork. You don't find pork very much due to the Muslims. You find a lot of sort of these areas in town, in the towns, which look sort of like a, sometimes they're a big tent, or sometimes it's sort of a partial building, but it's sort of an outside, inside sort of an eating area, and they usually have these tables set up, but then they'll have all these rows of like little food stands, and they were sort of like mom and pop food areas, and it would be all different kinds. And so this is just one that didn't have anybody at it, and you could see the walks there. But you would get all sorts of food, Chinese food and Indian food. And so this is me trying to eat with chopsticks, and then the lady there laughing at me. She thought it was so funny. And then drinking a plum drink. Now, what was sort of funny with the group is when they love to eat, and so they love to eat and take pictures. That's what I learned. When we eat, though, they like to eat really hot food. And so when I started off eating with them, I wouldn't eat anything hot because I didn't want to just kill myself. But as we went along, I started trying more and more, and they were like really proud of me. They thought I had, and I said, well, we eat hot food back in the U.S. But they'd ask me a lot, what do you eat in the U.S.? Hamburgers? So they could never get out of their minds as to, you know, that we actually were multicultural too, and we ate more things than just hamburgers. So I told one lady, I said, I like Korean food. We go to a restaurant in Albuquerque that I like. And she said, well, that food's no good. Here's the real food here. So they can get, the other thing they could never figure out was New Mexico. So I'd say I was from the U.S. and from New Mexico. And they said, oh, you're from Mexico. I said, no, I'm from the U.S. and the state is New Mexico. So I'd have to share with them that it was California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, because they knew Texas and California. But they just couldn't figure this out. They would say, well, was it once part of Mexico? And I said, yeah, it was. All that area was once part of Mexico. And so, but they just couldn't figure that out.
We can't figure it out.
Yeah, we can't figure it out either. So what we did all week, so this was a five-day planned distribution. And so we arrived Saturday morning. It was about a 30-hour plane trip that included layovers. Sunday, we did a church service, very similar to the church services we do here in the U.S. and some sightseeing. And then Monday through Friday, we did distributions at all these cities, and our teams broke up with the locals to do this. And then on Friday evening, we had a pastor's appreciation banquet. And so that's very similar to what we did in the U.S. And then Saturday morning, we took a 5 a.m. flight back to the U.S. I asked them there when I got in the car. So the car we got in, there was all five of us in this little minivan that didn't have air conditioning. It was about 90 degrees and 90% humidity. And I asked the driver, so when is winter here? And he said, we don't ever have winter here. We have just hot and humid, or hotter and more humid. And so I'm not sure what season we were in there, but it was hot and humid. This shows just a picture of Penang Bridge as we're going over it, and then the Sunway Hotel where we stayed at. The Blitz headquarters was at this hotel that was in Butterworth, and it was called the Sunway Hotel. When we booked the hotel, they said it was going to be $70 a night, and I thought, oh no, it's going to be a dump. And so we got to it, and it turned out the rooms were very nice, the eating area was very nice, and it was $70 a night that included breakfast. And these breakfasts wasn't your traditional U.S. continental breakfast. This was like a 10-course meal that they would set up for breakfast with meatballs or curry and just all sorts of dinner-type things. And this is a picture looking out my window. This is an interesting picture here, looking out of the 15th floor of the hotel. There's three temples that are located here. There's a Hindu temple, or I think this is a Buddhist temple, a mosque that's here, and then a Hindu temple, all located sort of in the same area. No Christian church, though. And then this is our team of people that went. But then we had a reality check. So everything, we got there, it was about 1 in the afternoon, and we were tired, and we were going to have this sort of a startup, a kickoff celebration that night. But Larry Aspergen calls us together and say, we're going to have a team meeting at 3 o'clock. So it was like 2:30, so we had 30 minutes to sort of get fresh and go to this team meeting. I put these two quotes in here because this was a reality check for me and for our whole team when we got there. We knew by looking at Wikipedia there were going to be some issues, but we didn't know what exactly they were going to be. This is a quote from Paul Washer. Persecution is always meant for evil, but God always means it for good. At our first team meeting, Larry Aspergen says, we're going to have a hard time distributing scriptures in this country because... And the because was that, well, there's another law in this country that you're not allowed to give out any religious material at all to a Muslim. And so we were like, so, okay, we can probably tell and you can get thrown in prison if you do. And in fact, there were some cases pending while we were there. So we said, okay, the ladies are easy to identify. They have on the scarves and things. But what about the men? And so Larry tells us, you're just going to have to rely on the local Gideons for help. And so that was very disturbing to us. The second one, and so we asked the question, what if we're on a distribution and a Muslim comes up and takes something from us? They said, you're not allowed to let them take anything from you. So not only are you not allowed to give out, you're not allowed to let them take anything. So that was hard. And then the second one, this blitz was supposed to have occurred 3 years ago, but it was postponed because there was an uprising, and I'm not sure if it was against Christians or just an uprising on Penang Island 3 years earlier and right before the blitz was supposed to occur, and the local Christian churches asked the Gideons to postpone the blitz. And so those two things were really a downer for us, and so we knew right away that we were going to have to rely on God to just take care of us. And so we went that night then to a fellowship banquet. I didn't take enough pictures here. I was still sort of jet-lagged and wasn't sure what I was doing. But we did get our shirts that night, and we met all the local Gideons, who or a lot of them, who would be participating. And they were just so encouraging. They were like, don't worry about it. We'll take care of this. We'll tell you when you shouldn't do something and when you should. And so so that was very encouraging. So let's see how I'm doing on time. So on Sunday, we did a church service, and there's sort of a funny story associated with this. You know, when we do Gideon presentations in churches, we usually plan on a 10-minute service. So that's what we plan for. That's what we prepare for. When I got to our team meeting and Larry was giving out the assignments, he said, well, Ed, I have you down for a 40-minute service at some Baptist church or something. I said, I have a lot of material, but I don't have enough material to go 40 minutes in a church. And this was an English-speaking church, so there wasn't even going to be an interpreter to help slow you down. And so so I said, well, I'd rather not do that. And so he gave it to somebody else, and he gave me a 10-minute service at this church. And I can't pronounce what it was, but we called it BMBC. So it was a Baptist, an English-speaking Baptist Chinese church that was there, about the size of our congregation that was there. They had two services, one in English and then a later one in the afternoon in Chinese. And so when I get there, so we get there about 15 minutes early, and the local guy who's there starts talking to me, and he says, oh, by the way, our pastor's not here today. It was Mother's Day. And he said, our pastor's not here today, so we'll let you have the whole service if you'd like to take the whole service. And I was like, what? And he said, well, you know, you can just go as long as you want. If we get out early, that's okay because it's Mother's Day and stuff. So I went as long as I could. I thought of every testimony I could possibly think of. And So anyway, that was fun. It's funny how God works. You think you're getting out of something, and he sticks you right back in. This is sightseeing. There's a lot of neat things, a lot of picturesque type things in Malaysia. A very beautiful country, but again, so hot and humid. I had to take a picture of this because I love to grow these plants down here at the house. You can ask Carol. These are Diefenbachias. And I told people, I grow these in my house. They didn't believe me. But I did. And then you see these types of things all throughout Malaysia, just temples everywhere. We went down this street. It was called something like Fish Street or something like that. And it was actually a wharf that went out. And the guy that was with us told us that everybody who lived there were Taoist. And so along the way, you would just see these little temples and things. And I said, well, what is it they worship? And he just said, they just worship pagan gods. They would worship anything. There would be a tree that would have like candles and incense and stuff around it. And it's like they worship that tree. And so just a lot of strange things like that. Now, James Freimiller warned me about this. I didn't know what he was talking about, but he said, well, watch out for the durian. And so you will see in the hotels, every hotel has a little sign outside the door, and it has like a picture of this fruit here. This is a durian fruit. They call it the king of all fruit. And it has a picture with a slash through it, so no durian allowed in the hotels. And the reason is it just stinks to high heaven. It smells, I don't know, just like something rank, and it tastes even worse. It's sort of like a mush inside. There's like a thing that's sort of mushy, and it has a seed inside. And so he bought enough that we each could have one, and you ate it. It sort of tasted like a mixture of kerosene and onions or something like that. And then it stayed with you the rest of the day. You couldn't get it off your skin or anything. The other thing they like are these coconuts, and they would have these raw coconuts everywhere, which were young coconuts, and you would drink the juice out of it and then peel the skin out of the inside, which was a couple of millimeters thick. So there's a couple of guys drinking it, more eating going on. This little girl here was actually the international representative who's there. His name's Alan Lowe, and his daughter is 16 years old. She wants to come to the U.S. and study in the U.S., but she would just, like, really love this durian. She just ate. I mean, we left a bunch of it, and his wife and her ate it all. And so they said you have to live there a while to get used to it. So my team, so we were separated into teams, and we were called a team leader. I'm not sure why, because we didn't really lead anything. We were just there as part of it. But these were sort of the three guys I was with the whole time I was there. Mugan was our driver and really the team leader for us, and then Simon and Mr. Tan. Mr. Tan here looks a lot older than he is. He's 67 years old, and some funny stuff. I usually ended up sitting next to him in the car, and I could never understand a single word he would say. So when he would say, he'd say, "Brother Ed," every time he'd say "Brother Ed," I was like, "Oh no, I'm not going to be able to understand him." And so I never was able to understand him. And so I would usually ask him to say it again. He'd say it again, and I'd like, "I don't know what you're talking about." So. But a lot of times there'd be a couple of other people in the car with us, and so the car would hold basically five people. In this case, we had six people in the car. We were trying to get somewhere. And so we would usually pick up a local person in a different city that knew the streets and that type of thing. And so it was a core team plus them. And so now I'm just going to go quickly through the days of the week that we had. And so we started out every day by going to a church usually and having a time of prayer and just direction as to what we were going to be doing that day, how we were going to be splitting up, meeting the local Gideons. And so this was our first meeting. It was on the island of Penang. So this was the area that was sort of dangerous, even though it was a resort area and industrial area. This is where they had the uprisings in the past. And so we were told that on school distributions, we wouldn't be able to participate. And so we could be in the back, we could help, but we probably shouldn't participate. The schools we did, so all the schools are government schools. There are some private schools. But the government schools that we did, they sort of have them segregated. So there would be a Chinese girls' school or there'd be a Chinese school, and there wouldn't be hardly any Muslims at that school. Then they'd have a school that was all Muslim schools, and so they were sort of segregated like that. So we didn't do any of the Muslim schools for good reason, but we did all the Chinese schools, and so we gave out the little blue Chinese testaments to all the school kids. The one thing that was funny about the whole area is everybody drove motorcycles, and I couldn't help but think of Glenn Riddle. And I thought, well, no wonder, you know, I don't see how people just don't get killed all the time on these motorcycles. And here's a good example. We were leaving, and there was this guy here with his little son or something just riding, you know, in front of him. And you saw this a lot, and it's not like they're just on some side road. He's like on the main road there in Penang. And so anyway, they were showing us where we'd be going that day, and then also some instructions about, you know, what we would have to be careful about. I don't know if you can see the picture right here in the middle. This is a monkey. This was something sort of funny I saw while we were driving around. There was electrical poles, and there were about six or seven monkeys that were climbing around here. And I noticed this one, he had a blue bag, and this was a huge blue bag, and he was just sitting up here, and he was picking trash out of the bag, and if it was edible, he'd eat it. Otherwise, he'd throw it down. And so below him, I wish I would have had the picture, but below him was this just big pile of trash that was down there. So so I asked him, what other animals around there? Are there any snakes or anything? I said, oh, yeah, there's boa constrictors around, so don't go off the path. And so, okay. But the area we did that day was mostly the northern part of Penang Island, and we did the resort hotels that were there. And that was sort of nice. We did both 5- and 6-star hotels there, chains like Holiday Inn. But most of these hotels were reluctant to take Bibles because of the Muslims that were there. And so they'd usually say some excuse like, well, we have to clear this with our headquarters. Or they'd say, you know, our clientele doesn't allow us to have Bibles in the hotel room. So they sort of used me as a pawn there, and they said, well, you see, you're white, and if we go in there and we say we're going to put these in the hotel room, they'll just say, well, who are you? You're just a Malaysian. Well, but they say, if you go in and you say you're an American, then that's going to be held in high esteem, and so we might be able to get some of these Bibles in the hotel room. So I was used sort of that way, and so I'd go in, and we'd talk to the manager, and we'd say something like, you know, we'd show them the Bibles and say, you know, we put these in all the American hotels. They're in all the American hotels, and we want them to be in your hotel, too. And it turned out most of them turned us down. But there were a lot of hotels that did accept them, and this was one case where the lady accepted the Bibles, and I think we gave out a couple of hundred there in the rooms. We also did the lower class hotels, and at the lower class hotels we gave out the little blue looking Chinese English Bibles. We didn't give out the regular hotel Bibles. We were waiting at a school, and this school was in the afternoon. It was a private school, and it was I guess there were some Americans there and Japanese and foreigners that went to this school. And so they told me that I could distribute there, but not to get too close. So I stayed on the other side of the street, and we were there about an hour earlier. And it turned out this was sort of a rich school where I guess people who lived on Penang Island that were business-type people would send their kids here, and a lot of them most of them were probably Chinese, Chinese-speaking. Or maybe I should put it this way. I was told that everybody who went to the schools in Malaysia learned Chinese. And so most of them could speak 3 or 4 different languages. And so we gave out the Chinese testaments here. But before the distribution started, we called this guy, let's see, this is him right here. We called him King David. He was one of our team members. And he really had a passion for evangelism. He was a businessman. His brother was studying to be a pastor. And he decided there was a row of cars, and there were like Jaguars and BMWs and Mercedes. And he said that, well, there's these guys that are bodyguards that come and pick up the kids. So the parents didn't pick up the kids. The drivers or the bodyguards did. So he decided to go and witness to two of them. He talked to them. So I stayed across the street and just tried to take some pictures. He talked to them for at least 30 minutes. The guy in pink said that he was willing to accept Christ as his Savior. And so King David showed him, he had New Testaments for him. He showed him in the New Testament some key verses and how to read it. So they each took a New Testament, but the guy in pink said that he would find a local church and that he was wanted to read the New Testament. So that was exciting. Then King David went and sat down with this sort of a grandpa guy. I think he was waiting for his granddaughter to come out of school. And he spoke Chinese, and so he talked to him for about 15 minutes. And he asked him, you know, when you die, where will you go, and that sort of thing. And the guy said, well, I believe when you die, you just die. You don't go anywhere. And so David tried to share with him that, no, when you die, if you don't know Jesus, you're going to go to hell. And so the guy really didn't want to listen, but he did take a New Testament, and he said he would read it. So that was great. So these things sort of went on every day. So every day we would try to do hotels, this is another city, hotels, clinics, and schools. So that was sort of the order that we did it in. The clinics were not like a clinic you would find in the U.S. These, in fact, you would probably not set foot in one of these clinics there, although they were private, and so you had to pay for it out of your own money. So if you didn't want to go to for the government health care, you would go to one of these clinics. And you notice the name here of this one, Clinic Dr. Quack. I just laughed about that. But they didn't think it was funny. They were like, what are you laughing about? And so we ended up leaving. We would leave 5 or 6 or maybe even 10 English, Chinese, and Tamil testaments there at the clinics. And so that was really interesting. When we go in these clinics, a lot of times it'd be a Muslim lady who was the head lady running the clinics. And so they would say, so since she was part of the clinic, then you could talk to her. You couldn't really share with her. And so they would say something like, we want to put these in your reading area, and they're not for you. They're for your customers. And so they try to make that clear, that it wasn't for them, it was for the customers. And a lot of times we would talk to the doctor who was there. And most of the time they would let us put the New Testaments in. These two girls were like 22 and 24, so they reminded me of my girls. We went, they weren't Gideons, but they were part of the church that we were at, and they wanted to go with us this day, and so we let them go. We went to this one hotel, and I showed the lady. So the lady came out, the manager, and she had the scarf on and everything. I thought, oh no, she's a Muslim. They're not going to want to take these. And so before we go to every hotel, it was great. Our driver, Mugan, was a great prayer warrior. He would just bathe everything in prayer before we'd go in. And so I showed her, I said, so it was sort of a middle-class hotel. It wasn't a second-class hotel. But it wasn't the kind that we would typically put in the Bibles. And so I had one of each, the little blue one and this one. And I told her, in America, we put these in all the hotel rooms across the United States. And so she looked at it, she looked at this one, she looked at the little blue one, she said, oh, I want those. And so, of course, they're so nicely bound and everything, and so we gave her about 100 Bibles for her hotel. Later on, we found out that some people we met at the church said something like, that's red now instead of green, what does that mean? Oh, it's not doing anything different. Okay. My time is up. Later on we found out the local Gideons there said, well, we've never even been to that hotel because we just figured that it was run by Muslims and they wouldn't accept Bible. So that just shows that, you know, you always have to go and try because you just never know what kind of reception you're going to get. More food. And then this was at a church. I went to use the restroom, and at the hotels they have just regular toilets. Here, this was throughout the rest of Malaysia, was like this. I still hadn't quite figured this out. I we'll move on. Then we did another school distribution. I think this is one reason Carol probably would never go with me to Malaysia, right? Yeah. Then on the next day, Wednesday, another city and more clinics. We went into one clinic that was a Christian clinic, and on the wall it said Jesus is Lord, and of course they accepted a number of New Testaments. Turned out that we were at this one church getting ready for a school distribution, and the Chinese Testaments that we had, for some reason they were all sticking together, and so they wouldn't separate, and so we decided this isn't going to work, and so we started separating the New Testaments, and we got all the church ladies and people that were there, the church involved, they wanted to participate in doing this, so that was a lot of fun. And then we did a Chinese school distribution, and this was sort of funny. We did this with the ladies, the auxiliary participated with us, and school was going to be out, like, usually they'd get out late, like sometimes like around lunchtime, and then like at 7 o'clock at night. So they'd have like two sessions. So this was like 7 o'clock at night, and we were ready, and this was like a big opening going back into the school, and it had probably 4,000 students there. And right before the bell rang, they all lined up like across the way. So here were we with our New Testaments, and they were lined up, and when the bell rang, they just all started running towards you. And so you're trying to hand these out. And it was sort of funny that a lot of the girls wouldn't take a New Testament from me. They wouldn't accept it. But these ladies, the auxiliary that was there, they wouldn't let anybody get past them without taking a New Testament. They would, if they said no, they don't want one, they'd take them, they'd shove it into their stuff to make sure that they got one. So they were very impressive. It turns out the sewer, or maybe it's not the sewer system, the drainage system in Malaysia is pretty interesting. There's these troughs everywhere. So if you're not careful, you could break your leg, and these are like usually sometimes 3-5 feet deep, and so you have to be sort of careful. A lot of street animals. We saw a lot of dogs and cats running around, so that was sort of interesting. This is called Chicken Street that we were on. And there, I didn't see any chickens there, though. And then Mugan had for us that day for lunch just this really wonderful Indian meal. And I guess I've never had actual real Indian, homemade Indian food. And so they all ate with their hands and showed me how to do it. I just couldn't do it. And so I'd eat some of the stuff with my hands, but they'd pick up rice and stuff and eat it with their hands. And it just was, I don't know, I just felt weird doing it. So they gave me a fork. Anyway, then this is Mugan at one of the clinics. He falls asleep then later. So he was our driver. So we let him sleep, and we walked around the rest of the city and did more clinics. On Thursday, we were back on Penang Island, but now we were in the southern part of the island, and here it was a little safer to work, and we did more hotels and schools. This is Mr. Tan. We decided that this one hotel we were going to go in was supposed to be a 6-star hotel, and so I was sort of joking with them that we had taken coats and ties and everything to go, but it was so hot that you just ended up wearing whatever short sleeve shirt you could find. And so I was joking with them that we really should be dressed up to go to this hotel. Well, Mugan is a bank manager, and he had a bunch of ties in his car. And so they all decided they're going to put ties on, and Mr. Tan could not tie a tie, so I tied it for him, and he wore that funky tie with his shirt going into the hotel room. And then this is one hotel we went to, and the guys were sort of funny. They found out this lady who was the manager of the hotel was had just come from the Philippines, and that she was a Catholic. And so they said, they knew that I had been a Catholic in the past. And so they said, Ed, you have to talk to her. And so I went and I talked to her some, and I gave a New Testament to her. And she was very anxious to read it. So I showed her some important places to read, especially like in the book of John. And so she was very excited to start reading. More food. So again, we would eat at least 3 times a day, maybe more. We'd usually stop and get a snack. The coconut things were funny because every time we'd stop, they'd ask me, did I want a coconut? And they'd say, it's like a soothing drink for you, to refresh you into. But I didn't think they were very good, so I would usually try to get a Coke if they had them. That's a duck. That's right there. And so you would see all sorts of strange food in the area. And then this was one where we had, this was called porridge. And so you could select whatever seafood types you wanted in your porridge. And then this was really good. This was satay. So this is the Indian food that's little skewers of chicken or beef that's put on a charcoal grill. So that was very, very good. And then Friday, again, some more hotels, more clinics, more schools. We had a lot of success at these hotels. They were sort of they weren't the lower class hotels, sort of middle class hotels, and they pretty much all accepted Bibles for their hotel room. It was sort of funny when we'd go to each hotel, and if they'd accept the Bibles for their rooms, Mugan was very insistent. So this is Mugan here. He was very insistent with telling the person we were giving them to, can we go into one of your rooms and show you exactly how to place the Bibles in the hotel room? And, you know, here you think, what's a no-brainer? You stick it in the drawer, and that's the end of it. But he had to show them, no, what you do is you take the Bible, you open the drawer, you place it in, you shut. And so he would do this, like, over and over. And so it must have just been that he really wanted to get into their heads, okay, you're going to go around to all the rooms, and you're going to do this exactly like this. And so this is another one of our team members, and he had just shown them how to do this, how to put they were the maids that were there at the hotel. So that's sort of funny. Again, more food. You would see a lot of things like this in Malaysia, and I don't know if these were Buddhist or Taoist or what, but it would be like a little shrine. There'd usually be some candles in it, some incense, and then some sort of food. And so I guess the only thing I can think of is they would just worship whatever god or whatever with whatever food they were sticking in there. And then there were a lot of fruit stands that had just wonderful fruit that you can't get in the U.S. This was watermelon, but there were mangoes and some fruit that I didn't even know what it was, and pineapple and just really wonderful, wonderful stuff. And then so the last day, these pictures I took at this near this school that we were at. So this was sort of the last school we did, and there was this little shack that was there by the school, but it had a TV dish on the top of it, so I thought that was interesting. And then just some neat pictures that were there. The school would let the kids out in waves, so it gave us a chance to sort of regroup, you know, get ready again, and then another 100 would come out. So we did this about 5 or 6 times. And then finally, that Friday night, we had a pastor's appreciation banquet, and of course by this time I had made some great friends there in Malaysia, and so we got to say our goodbyes. And it was actually the 25th anniversary of the Butterworth camp was celebrated that night as well. So this is just some of the auxiliary ladies preparing for the pastor's appreciation banquet. We had well over 100 pastors there. We had a seven-course Chinese meal that was about $25 a person. And this was one of the seven courses. It was this giant fish that had been fried and then had some sort of hot sauce on it and stuff. And so this is this guy, Bruce, he's cutting it up. Bruce was not one of my team members, but he was the guy that picked us up at the airport, and right away everybody had a bond with him. He was just always joking around, and he told me, you know, he was the one that made sure we got the durian, and I told him I didn't like the durian. That was not any good at all. And so he said, well, I've got another fruit that you're going to like a lot, and it's called dragon fruit. And so he promised me that he would get me some dragon fruit before we left. And so I told him he didn't have to do that, but he brought these then on the night of the pastor's banquet, and they were these big type things, and they come in either red or white, and they have just a bunch of seeds inside, and they're very sweet and very delicious, and I don't know why you can't get this in the U.S., but you can't. And so he cut this up for everybody. This just shows a picture of Mugan and his wife, and then the director there in the Pacific Rim, Alan Lowe, and his family. And this is sort of everybody who participated that was there at the pastor's banquet. These were just some extra slides. I sort of already talked about those. I said earlier, we gave out last year almost 90 million Bibles and New Testaments throughout the world. In total, we've given out about 2 billion total since 1899 when the Gideon started. And of the 108 million... that's required to purchase these, about 74% comes from the U.S. So anyway, I think that's my last slide. So anyway, I just got a couple more minutes. Does anybody have any questions?
I was just asking the motels, if you pull out a used Bible, I don't know, there or over here or there, are you able to recycle any of the gently used ones? Say, for instance, here, because my folks have a Christian bookstore in California, we could take it into the jails as long as you had the hardcover off.
Right. That's what we do here. So when we pull the Bibles back from the hotels at Scripture Blitzes, we'll take the covers off, put on a soft cover, and those go to our prisons. Yeah, so they get a second life. They're replaced about every 7 years. In our camp, so our camp, South Camp, is everything south of Central. There's only one hotel that won't accept Bibles. It's the hotel you guys had your reception at, the Park Plaza. Yeah. So, but we keep trying. We go there every year and just say, "Would you like them now?" So, any other question? Yeah. Scott.
With such a plurality of religions, I presume the general populace thinks that one religion is just as good as another depending on your heritage. There's no uniqueness to the truth of Christianity.
Well, that's probably true. I mean, I would expect that. But in some sense, it's a lot like the U.S., too. I mean, you find that exactly the same. Same thing here. And so that wasn't so odd. What was hard for me is when you go on one of these Scripture Blitzes, you sort of, like even when you do it in the U.S., you sort of, or when we do a school distribution like at UNM, you get so used to wanting to share the Bible and share the gospel that then as you see people on the street, you want to just give them a New Testament. And so that was hard to restrain yourself there because you think, okay, I don't know if they're a Muslim or not. And so we had to be very careful. But it seemed like for the most part, the people we did give to were very receptive. Buck? No, I don't know how long it's been. So most of the people that I worked with were, I guess, sort of Chinese. It was hard to figure out exactly what they all were. But they have this sort of attitude towards the Muslims, and I don't know how much longer they're going to be able to have the country peaceful because the Chinese people think they do all the work and the Muslims get all the benefit. And so there's laws, there's tax breaks for Muslims that aren't for the rest of the people. And so there's this hostility that's there because the Chinese people feel like they're the hard workers. And all these restaurants and everything were all entrepreneurial Chinese people. There were no Muslim cafes.
When I went to Russia, my first trip, all the literature we distributed had an address locally where they could write for more information. Is that possible
to get in? No, it's so usually just in the New Testament. There's usually maybe a web address or something like that. So. Okay, I think I'm done. So thank you all for listening and thank you again for praying for me. It was a great time. So.